Hey everybody, welcome again to another episode of F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined this morning by JB.
Hello, listeners.
We're talking about JB's favorite movies. The moment has finally arrived on the podcast. We've been doing everybody's favorite movies leading up to our 100th episode, which will happen next week at the end of the very first F This Movie Fest Film Festival, which you can find out about by going to fthismovie.blogspot.com and reading all about the festival February 4th, noon till whenever, 10-ish.
I am literally tingling with excitement, and my box of things that you could win continues to grow, and that's not a euphemism.
Five movies. Follow us on Twitter to join in, twitter.com/fthismovie. Like I said, go to fthismovie.blogspot.com to read all about the festival, and you should like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie or email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Could be, who knows? Virtual festival coming. Yes, it would, even in your neighborhood. Maybe tonight. I keep waiting for Patrick to sing the Maria part.
I don't know the Maria part.
Also, I'd like to give a shout out to my students in northern Minnesota. They've been delightful lately, and I just this week I put something together that I had never put together. As most of you know, I teach somewhere in northern Minnesota. It's Northern Minnesota High, and I can't believe I never put these two facts together. Our mascot,
yes,
that accompanies our sports teams,
yes,
is the Haverick.
Oh, wow.
And you should see, we have this very elaborate Haverick costume that every year it's an honor that some student
gets
to run around in. I won't bother describing it.
Make sure you bring it to the FS Movie Fest on February 4th. One of our listeners, Sarah DeLallo, suggested that we do an Academy Awards show, but having nothing to do with the actual Academy Award nominations, which are horrible and boring, but that we just nominate our own movies that we want to win and have the listeners vote, and that perhaps the main award, the best picture, if you will, is the Golden Haverick.
I think that's a great idea, and it should all be in the spirit of, I guess, when the nominations were announced, mostly awful, Patton Oswalt, with his usual sense of humor, began to tweet that he was having this party for all the people who deserved to get a nomination and didn't. And it was really funny, because he accurately commented on who really...
Yeah, everybody was left out.
This is the... At some point during this year's Academy Awards ceremony, someone should get up and do a Kim Basinger. Do you remember that?
No.
Oh, that was my favorite moment. The year that Driving Miss Daisy won.
Okay.
Another film that talked about some of the same issues wasn't even nominated. And Kim Basinger, probably emboldened by her then marriage to Alec Baldwin, got up, went off script, and said maybe the biggest irony of the evening is that the film that showed us the most focused glimpse into that issue wasn't even nominated.
Was this Do the Right Thing?
It was her shout out to Do the Right Thing, and I was like, well, this is what the Academy Awards needs more of.
Yeah, more Kim Basinger.
Sure.
So like I said, we're talking about JB's five of JB's favorite movies, JB's five favorite movies, the last five movies that JB has seen.
Listen, that's something we've commented on, that very often young people who we love will say that their favorite movie is the right. last movie they saw,
right.
which seems to be some sort of weird memory.
Yeah.
State or something.
The best movie I've ever seen is Underworld Awakening. I did not actually see Underworld. His face just changed in a way that was like, you saw Underworld Awakening? I did not see
it. This is what makes me wish this were a video podcast, because the last time I went to this theater that we've talked about, that all of us go to and we all love, they had put... Oh, you were with me.
Yeah.
They put Haywire in a theater that was too small.
Yeah.
Considering it was the opening weekend.
And packed full.
And in the middle screens, the middle of this theater has the big screens. The right. screen, when you're buying your ticket, you're hoping, man, right. give me 16, 14, give me 15, 17. 16.
And now one 16, of those is IMAX, so now 17. You're kind of down to three. But
they had Underworld, whatever yeah. it is, on three of those four screens.
Yep.
Is money changing hands? I'll even give you two, because it's an IMAX. I'll
right.
give you two.
Right.
Two in the middle.
Right.
But it's Steven Soderbergh.
I don't know. Yeah. And Soderbergh even said that he toyed with the idea of shooting Haywire in IMAX because he had just done it with Contagion, and he sort of liked the format. But as soon as they sort of asked around, they found out that Underworld Awakening already had all of the IMAX real estate for that weekend.
Wow.
Things are decided that far in advance.
Okay, and just a heads up, you may want to watch this, you might watch, no, you may want to listen to this podcast in bed, because I think it's going to put some people to sleep.
Oh, fun. I hope me too.
Because I'm elderly.
Oh, right.
I've come to the conclusion that I'm elderly. And apparently, I can no longer see colors because, for some strange reason, all of my films but one are in black and white.
But they're all recent.
Is in black and white.
But they're all recent black and white films: Woody Allen's Celebrity, The Good German,
The Artist. Dare I mention
my favorite film of the year?
It was so cute.
I have to. Charming. It was charming.
The little white dog. It's a love letter to the movies.
I have to read our last group of listener submissions for the Win Our Stuff contest, which I guess there's still time to do in theory if you want to do this between now and the festival, but we're announcing the winners on the 100th episode podcast, February 4th.
You need to send an email this week, and to make it easier, everything that comes out of my mouth today could be a potential favorite moment.
I like it. So here's a last group of submissions for the favorite moment in our 100 episodes. Clint writes, trying to choose just one favorite moment from the show is like trying to choose the craziest Nicolas Cage performance, a nearly impossible task. There are so many insights and outright hilarious moments to choose from the Quibbler to Marcon's rapturous tale of kidnap to Alex's painful admission of his love for Wild Wild West. We laughed, we cried, we even became a bit frightened at times. But out of it all, I would have to say the single greatest moment was when, after enjoying a delicious plate of Erica's Top Gun cookies, Doug told with childlike excitement of the Havoc, the adrenaline-fueled jungle cat that will surely live on in F-This Movie history. May the Havoc forever prowl and delight!
Wow.
Yeah, right? So there's another vote for the Havoc, but of course, Marcon being kidnapped also gets a mention. Saul writes, I was having a hard time with this as I've listened to so many of your podcasts lately and generally enjoy them so much that it's hard to narrow it down to a moment. But JB reminded me of this on your latest podcast. It's a so bad it's good moment or collection of moments. The Quibbler. Oh man, that sucked so bad it was good. The awful wah wah music that accompanied the mere mention of his name. Patrick's perhaps unintentional but nevertheless obvious dislike of the gag all capped off JB's assurances that the Quibbler would not be returning. Great stuff, like a lovely flower growing in a pile of shit.
And two things about that. Number one, I have it on very reliable counsel that the Quibbler might be making an appearance on the 100th podcast.
He has to.
Although
he's part of the show.
Patrick has installed new locks in his house to keep the Quibbler out. Second of all, this email fascinates me because it's the story of my life. My favorite moment is something that JB did that was shitty. So irony defines my life. I go back to high school, and you know at the end of high school they give out all those awards? Not to brag, I was voted funniest and also worst joke teller. What the hell?
Great material, horrible delivery.
I think what they couldn't understand is that the joke was that it wasn't a joke. See, right. I was already meta.
Right. Wow. You invented meta?
Way ahead of the curve. But I have a sentimental affection for the Quibbler. This morning, my wife and I were discussing that the Quibbler needs a new sound effect, but thanks, Saul. That made my day.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you, Saul. And for the record, I don't think I hated the Quibbler. I was very sick when we recorded that podcast.
Well, that's what you claim now.
Go back and listen.
Well, I was in the room with you, and I...
I was sick. Also, we were talking about Super 8, which I loved, and I would tolerate no dissent
from
the Quibbler. And lastly...
But not leastly...
We have an audio recording from Heath. This very early on, I had said, hey, if you want to just record something, send us an MP3 and we'll play it on the show. And no one did it. A couple people tried, but I think they misunderstood the directions and just sent clips from our show. Heath actually recorded something, so I will play that now.
Hey, F This Movie, this is Heath Holland, one of your favorite listeners. I just wanted to give you guys congratulations on your 100th episode, which is a big deal, especially in this day and age where a lot of podcasts don't make it into the double digits. And it didn't take you guys like 5 years to get to your 100th episode either. You've gone through them really quickly, and every week. And I appreciate it. And it's become, actually, it's the only movie podcast that I listen to these days. I have tried many, and I've dropped them all for a variety of different reasons. But the one that makes you special, the most special, in my opinion, is that you are delightfully unpretentious. And for one thing, it's F this movie, and it's not F this film. You love movies. You don't put them on this unattainable, untouchable pedestal. But at the same time, it's because of people like JB that I have the Universal box set, or Universal Monsters box set, and that I ordered a bunch of Charlie Chaplin DVDs, and I'm interested in the Marx Brothers. You guys can talk about French cinema, and then you can go into a conversation about Ghostbusters. It's just unrestrained. There are no borders. There are no boundaries. Nothing is really off limits, and it's fantastic, and I love the show, and I love what you guys are doing with it, and I just wanted you to know that 100 episodes is a big deal. We're out here. We're listening. We appreciate it, and thank you for doing the show for us, and I hope that it continues for a really long time. So thank you to all of you guys who make F This Movie, to Patrick, Erica, Doug, JB, Alex, Mike, Javier, Victor, Isabella, Sergey, and to Ink. Thank you guys all so much, the regular F This Movie contributors, for making it an awesome show that I can't wait to listen to every single week. I've heard them all, and I can't wait for the next one. It's the first one to listen to every time that it comes out. So thank you guys again. I'll talk to you later.
So, wow, thank you very, very much, Heath.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that, yep. And it actually succeeded in piercing my cynical black heart. Wow.
Super, super,
really
super nice
words.
And meaningful and helps us.
Although I would quibble with one thing. I am pathetically unpretentious.
Anyway, we really, really appreciate that, Heath, and everybody who wrote in. It's been really great reading everybody's emails and knowing that people enjoy the show, and we love talking about movies with everybody, so thank you. And make sure you listen to the 100th episode so that we read the names of the people who win our stuff.
And the 100th episode, again, not to pick your favorite metaphor for what I'm about to do, is going to be a first. Usually the Secret Service will not allow more than three of us to be in one place in one time in case God forbid, happens. There's
right.
a tragedy.
Right.
But they've doubled their detail on our enemies in the surrounding neighborhood. And Saturday night, there's going to be five of us.
I believe so.
Possibly six.
Right.
Live in the same room.
Yeah.
And you're going to want to listen because it's been 2 years. I hate Mark Ahn. And there could be a fist fight. Which I think even audio only, I think that would come across.
Make sure you listen. I have no idea what it's going to sound like with that many of us in the same room. I have no idea what that's going to sound like. But
I had floated the idea of just having a bicycle horn and limiting my participation to a Harpo Marx like I agree honk or I disagree different sounding honk.
Right. But what if we don't understand the difference in the honks and three honks means I'm choking? But we just think you're excited. Anyway, JB, before we talk about your favorite movies, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, it's odd. After the incredible high of last year and this crazy notion I had to see way too many movies in a theater, I sort of stopped. It's like a hangover or something.
Well, nothing's out.
Well, that's January and February is usually a trash yard.
Yeah.
But I did finally see Melancholia. And sort of went in very reserved and very guarded and actually liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those films that the farther away I get from it, the more it sticks in my mind, the more I think about it. I was really expecting to hate it for a number of reasons, but I really liked it a lot. I saw Haywire with You.
Yes.
Which I thought was very entertaining.
Yes.
And is sort of being brushed aside. It doesn't.
Well, it didn't really make any money. It got decent critical reviews, but the last podcast we recorded, I hadn't seen Haywire, but I was pretending like I had because it had come out by the time the podcast was released. But now I've actually seen Haywire. I thought it was entertaining, but let me float something by you. The reviews have been generally positive, but a lot of people, both critics and sort of fanboys alike, have singled out Gina Carano's performance as being distractingly bad, which I don't necessarily agree with. But I find there's a weird double standard at work, because I think a lot of these same people, perhaps not the critics, but definitely the fanboys, really enjoy, both unironically and ironically, the films of, like, Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme and Schwarzenegger and Stallone. And
Chuck Norris.
Right, all these action heroes. And no one is ever saying that the bad performance of the male action star is distracting from the movie.
And three of the five that we just named are famously wooden.
Right.
Fantastically.
And I think that was a thing that people pointed out very early, but then they became successful and it just became part of the movie. That you'd go into it knowing, okay, this guy's going to be bad, but he's going to kick a lot of ass, and that's part of what I like about it. So why is it that everyone is making that claim about Gina Carano?
Well, just off the top of my head, first of all, I don't agree. I don't think it's a bad performance. And I think for most of the film, maybe because they were anticipating, she's in Ultimate Fighting, or mixed martial arts or something, that anticipating that she might not be a season-trained actor, many of the sequences don't give her a lot of dialogue.
Right.
But in the scene that starts out, I don't think this is a spoiler, the scene that starts out with her having to be arm candy for Michael Fassbender, and they go to this sort of very rich party, I thought she handled that well, and I thought that there was nothing about her performance that was distracting. And in some ways, that's the most acting she does, because she gets all dressed up and she's, you know, pretending to be this guy's wife or girlfriend or something. No, I don't have a problem with her performance at all.
I just thought it was odd that it was being, and I'm not going to, you know, cry sexism necessarily, but I just think it's weird that so many people are pointing out.
I think you're correct to point out a double standard, though, because has anyone ever asked male action stars to emote?
Right. Right. I don't know. And I thought, you know, like you said, she's not given a lot of dialogue, and I thought she, she's maybe not a gifted actress, but I think she does what she's asked to do well. And I think she's very watchable, not just because she's very pretty, but like because she just commands the screen.
In fact, in a weird way, might we want our male action stars to be ciphers? Might we want them to be blank slates? Because then it's easier for 13-year-old boys to pretend that it's them.
Perhaps. Perhaps. Anything besides Melancholia and Haywire?
Yesterday, I watched Godspell again.
Oh, jeez.
Trying to reclaim my youth, because I was raised a nice Catholic boy, and that was our seventh grade field trip. They put us on a school bus, and they took us to a movie theater where we saw Godspell. And
you saw the movie Godspell?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I thought when you said that you saw Godspell, I thought you meant the live stage show of Godspell.
Parochial schools are traditionally criminally underfunded. There's no way they could have scraped up enough money to take us to a live performance.
I'd rather go to the movie than
This was a movie theater.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember it, because we grew up in the same area. Not the Mount Prospect. That was a double screen, and now that's a banquet hall.
Okay.
I'm talking about the Prospect Theater, which was in downtown Mount Prospect, was incredibly tiny.
Okay.
And when they knocked it down, it became a parking lot that fit maybe 10 cars.
Is that the one that used to run Rocky Horror, or was that the Mount Prospect?
That was the Mount Prospect.
Okay.
Mount Prospect was right by a bowling alley.
Mount Prospect had the balcony?
The Prospect had a small balcony.
Okay. When I was a kid, we went to see something at the Prospect, maybe Search for Spock, and I had maybe just learned about Abraham Lincoln, and I remember specifically being very nervous about sitting in the balcony because I was convinced we were going to be shot.
You don't want to sit in the balcony, but Godspell is just this curious thing from the 70s. Usually in class every year, I show one musical number from it as part of this larger lecture about something else. And the only thing I can say is, kids, the 70s were an ugly time. It was an ugly time. I was there.
I've never seen the movie. I've seen the stage production done by high schoolers, and it was a dark, dark night. But
I think there's a way to do it.
Yeah.
I don't think that way has been found. Some of the songs are very pretty. I mean,
sure. Day by Day is the only one I know still.
And again, because it's at the end of Wet Hot American Summer. But you have to remember, I had what seemed like a lifetime of attending mass because I went to a Catholic school once or twice a week. Part of school, we're not having math, we're going to mass. And this was the era of the guitar mass because they were trying to make it more relevant for kids. And I would say I've heard the song Day by Day thousands of times. To just become a teenager's who can barely play the guitar and another one who thinks he can sing.
It worked out day by day. I saw yesterday, I went to see Man on a Ledge, which is not a great movie, and I'm not going to suggest that people go see it, but I'm pretty sure right now, maybe it's because it's January and it's a bad month, and it was what I was in the mood for. You've talked many times about sort of the Book of Eli effect. I'm not going to say that by the end of the year, Man on a Ledge is going to be one of my favorite movies, but it's more, I think Unstoppable is the movie that you refer to, or it's just like, this is idiotic, but it's what I'm in the mood for, and it was fun. That was my feeling about Man on a Ledge. It delivered. Yeah. A ridiculous movie, and gets more ridiculous as it goes along, but I had a lot of fun watching it.
And you said you're not suggesting we see it, but once you mentioned the Book of Eli effect, I instantly say, I have to see that, so later in the year, I can point to it as my book of... And now the mirror is reflecting the mirror.
It is a ridiculous movie. And in keeping with trying to clear out some old titles in my collection and rewatch or watch for the first time some older movies that I've never seen, I watched Witness for the Prosecution for the first time, which I liked but didn't love. And maybe it's just because it's Billy Wilder and I expected to really love it. My favorite thing about the movie, obviously, is Charles Laughton's performance.
Yeah.
He's a ton of fun to watch. I thought the rest of it was a little bit... stiff, maybe? I don't know. And maybe because it's British or it's based on an Agatha Christie book.
It doesn't age well.
Right.
You can see that perhaps when it was released, people found it easier to get over that because it was a sort of a more formal, stiffer time.
Right.
I agree, Lawton's the whole show.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a movie that Charles Laughton doesn't liven up. Yeah. I mean, he was just... so incredible. And obviously, a couple months ago, we all watched Island of Lost Souls, parts of which don't age well.
But, I think it's held up pretty well.
But his performance...
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's explaining to the male lead exactly what he's done. And he sort of leans back on an operating table, and he's kind of this overweight man-child. And he gets this look on his face like he's done something unspeakably dirty and they've just caught him and he doesn't care. It's this grin of bacchanalian satanic delight. It's like, oh my God, can you see why this film was banned in England?
Yeah, right. And there's maybe 20 years between Island of Lost Souls and Witness for the Prosecution. And in that time, Charles Laughton was a bigger guy in Island of Lost Souls, but by Witness for the Prosecution, he is like... what Patton Oswalt refers to as B-word fat, where he's sweating just sitting down.
And then maybe I'm having a hard time with the dates, but you look at him in Spartacus at the very end of his career, and he's so good in that, too.
I've never seen Spartacus.
The last scene that he has in Spartacus is sort of this wonderful actor's moment that sort of, I don't know if he made any films after Spartacus, I'd have to look it up, but it's just such a wonderful moment that should have been the last moment of his career. He was terrific, and he was married, some would say a marriage of convenience, to one of the stars of one of my favorite films.
And they are together, they are on screen together in Witness for the Prosecution, which was kind of cool. Let's talk about your five favorites.
Okay, in the spirit of non-existent suspense, let's start at five.
I like it.
And
are these ranked?
These are ranked.
Okay.
And again, it's impossible. It's an impossible question. It's a desert island question.
Right.
Number five is Dr. Strangelove. Difficult choice. The five spot, I don't know if anyone else has commented on this, the five spot is difficult.
Well, this is the same as when we do the top ten. The ten spot is always hard because... it could be any number of movies.
I think I picked it because I think it's one of the funniest movies ever made. Various lists from the American Film Institute and IMDb and other places that maintain such lists would agree with me. I mean, it's certainly not a controversial choice. But I think the humor holds up in that I think I've seen the film 50 or 60 times. And every time I see it, something else makes me laugh. I also think I picked it because... and I go back to Mike's podcast, which I really enjoyed last week, and he was talking about films that made him realize something that sort of sparked your interest in film or made you see that, oh, you've been thinking that movies are this, but movies can also be this. And I discovered Dr. Strangelove very early on. And I'm old enough where when I was a kid, it was really hard to see movies, not just because your parents wouldn't take you. Mm-hmm. I know Patrick had that interesting.
And when they did, it was to the balcony to be shot.
He just escaped a bullet. That when I was growing up, my parents weren't big on going downtown. My father ceaselessly said, that's why I moved here, to get you two away from there. And you had to rely on TV, and there were only five or six TV stations. I know I'm sounding like Grandpa, but CBS used to show Dr. Strangelove at 11 o'clock at night, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. I later found out why. And I would seek it out. I would stay up. I would pretend to be asleep, wait for my parents to be asleep, and I would wake up and I would sneak it on. And I had never seen anything like it. It didn't look like a comedy. It didn't announce itself as, hey, we're going to be wacky, like right. So many comedies that right. young people are fed. You would watch it, and again, I'm 10 years old. This seems to be really serious, and, you know, the war room and the black and white cinematography. And then the more you thought about it, the more you would think, this is really, really funny. And I think your first inroad into that is the George C. Scott performance. Mm-hmm. Which I think I've talked about before on the podcast. It's just one of the most amazing performances. And I recently found out George C. Scott was very angry when Dr. Strangelove was finished and said, I will never work with Kubrick again. Because apparently, in rehearsals, Kubrick would encourage George C. Scott to take it to overact.
Right.
And he would film it.
Okay.
And some of that's in the movie.
Oh.
And George C. Scott was not happy about that at all.
Yeah, right.
But it's the size of the performance,
right.
The way he slaps his belly, the amazing scene when he's pointing to the big board, walks backwards, trips, does a somersault, gets up, and keeps saying his line.
Which is supposedly an actual mistake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can tell.
Right.
Supposedly, Peter Sellers was supposed to play four roles.
Right.
Because apparently, Kubrick wanted it to be everywhere you look, the fate of mankind rests on Peter Sellers. However, I just found out that the studio said, that's what we want. We will bankroll this film if Peter Sellers plays four parts.
He was supposed to play Slim Pickens, right?
He was supposed to play Kong, the pilot of the airplane that gets through. Because apparently, the studio had seen Lolita and actually thought the success of that film was based on the fact that Peter Sellers impersonates other people. If you've ever seen Lolita, which is another great film,
yeah,
I mean, it's
yeah.
so terrific. Certainly that's part of its charm,
mm-hmm.
but that's not the reason that
right.
film is a
right.
success. So in a weird way, oh, and also he had played a lot of parts in The Mouse That Roared. So I think the studio, having sort of tunnel vision, says, well, when Peter Sellers plays a lot of different parts, audiences like that. And apparently, Terry Southern, who co-wrote the script, had recorded Kong's lines in a Texas drawl. And apparently Peter Sellers couldn't get it. Now,
right.
there's various stories about this, because the official story is he sprained his ankle. He couldn't fit in that claustrophobic
mm-hmm.
cockpit set.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to get Slim Pickens. They also offered it to John Wayne, who turned it down.
No surprise there.
They offered it to Dan Blocker, who played Hoss on Bonanza,
okay.
and his agent declared the script too pinko. So they got Slim Pickens, and that film made Slim Pickens' career.
But he was not told it was a comedy?
Apparently, Slim Pickens thought it was a drama. And if you think about it, think of the scenes he's in.
Right.
It's
with the exception of his last scene. At that point, does he know it's a comedy?
Maybe Kubrick saved that for last.
Right.
And said, Slim Pickens had commented that after Strangelove, he got bigger parts and more money, and that sort of opened up his career. So the sprained ankle is the official story, but apparently Peter Sellers didn't think he could nail that part
mm-hmm.
and didn't want it to be, you know, half-assed. But his Dr. Strangelove is one of the most amazing characters in the film. When you show the film to teenagers, they instantly want to imitate Dr. Strangelove and do his voice and mannerisms. His president is kind of amazing. There's that scene that's justifiably famous where he's talking on the phone to the Russian premier. Right. And the Russian premier is having this wild, drunken orgy. And can you turn the music down, Dmitri? Dmitri. And it's really funny. Apparently, one of Sellers' ideas that Kubrick didn't like was that President Muffley would have a cold. And that would sort of run through it. And I only recently read about this. And apparently there's a couple shots where you can see little remnants of that.
Okay.
But apparently, I don't know, he would cough, he would sneeze, he would blow his nose, and it was making the other cast members laugh. Although, there's a moment during his phone call to Dmitri where you can see Peter Bull, the big Russian ambassador, and he's about to lose it. He's about, if you, obviously your eyes are on Sellers because he's in the middle of the frame.
Right.
But if you look, I believe it's to the left, don't quote me, and Peter Bull looks like he's just about to lose it. Maybe this is another introduction to irony, that this is a film that looks like a serious war drama.
Definitely.
And sounds like a serious war drama.
Yeah.
Most of the score is drums playing When Johnny Comes Marching Home.
Right.
State-of-the-art special effects for its day. Yeah. I think when I show it in class, students have a real hard time with the flying plane looking a little...
Right.
Is
that, would you say this is your favorite comedy of all time?
Probably. Although
on the list,
we can argue that number two is a comedy, but I'll leave that for better minds.
Okay.
The other reason why I included it, I think, is when I was a kid, I kept seeking it out, and no matter what time it was on, I would try to sneak out of my bed and watch it. I later found out that TV programmers in Chicago back then knew that if they programmed Citizen Kane, people would watch that no matter what time they showed it. Citizen Kane, we'll get ratings with that even if we put it on at 3 o'clock in the morning. So they scheduled the garbage at 3:30 in the afternoon, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, at 7 o'clock in the afternoon, because the time slot was more accessible.
Right.
People want to watch TV then,
right.
Program junk. But if they knew, like, let's show this, I almost revealed the name of another one of my films, that they would show it at crazy times. So I'm in love with Dr. Strangelove. The first time I bought the Leonard Maltin book, I think I'm 11, I buy it and I open it up to see if Dr. Strangelove is in there. And I thought, like, I was the only person who knew, you know, that strange thing when you're a kid?
Yeah, right.
I'm the only one who knows about this.
Right.
And I open Maltin to Dr. Strangelove and 4 stars and the write-up goes on and on and on. And it's like, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to high school and my high school film study teacher shows it. And I'm incredibly excited. And there are some students who are far less interested in high school who take that class.
Right.
Let's leave it at that. And for 3 days in class, it plays to silence. 3 weeks later, at the late lamented Varsity Theater in Evanston, which used to show old movies,
right.
and I used to go to all the time in high school, I go see Dr. Strangelove. The audience is packed. You cannot hear the dialogue
that
people are laughing so hard. And I sat in the theater and I was like, high school ain't life.
Yeah.
What? How to define this schism?
Right. Right. And obviously it just has to do with these are movie people and these high school people aren't. But like you said, if they're just sitting there sort of letting the movie wash over them, as high school students will often do, without actually paying attention to what's being said. Like you said, there are no indicators, except for a few things, that the movie is funny at all.
I can't think of an American comedy with fewer ironic clues.
Right. I mean, it really plays like a drama. Again, I think until Sellers shows up as Dr. Strangelove, I think he's sort of an indicator that, like, oh, he's doing something funny because the voice is funny and he's slapping himself.
And again, from showing it in high school film study classes, I have yet to have a class that did not respond to, gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Right, right. But there are a lot of, the last time I watched it, and I have a weird relationship with Stanley Kubrick and with Dr. Strangelove even, that it's taken me a few times to warm up to it. But that's true of Stanley Kubrick in general. For a long time, I was kind of like, I don't get it. He makes me feel stupid because I feel like I should be liking these movies more than I do. But every time I see them, I like them more. But even George C. Scott saying, you can't let him in here, he'll see the big board. That makes me laugh.
And the way he says it.
Or you'll have to answer to Coca-Cola.
The way he says it is this 12-year-old who has a secret. He'll see the big board.
Right.
And again, that's where the laugh plays off the seriousness, because that war room set is a masterpiece. I also found out that Ken Adam, who designed the sets, he also designed a lot of James Bond films. His original concept for the war room, Kubrick vetoed. He didn't like it. And then they came up with this enormous space with this highly polished floor and this Germanic ring of lights. Also, another thing I didn't know, because the film's in black and white, the table they're all sitting around.
Mm-hmm.
Kubrick insisted that the table, what's the word when you put cloth on something? Be upholstered?
Okay.
That's not the right word.
Okay.
Green felt, because he wanted them to feel like they were sitting around a poker table and that the fate of the world was being wagered.
It's weird that he didn't make any. This is really his only comedy. I mean, he has other. I mean, Lolita is sort of a.
Well, I would say that Lolita is a comedy, and that Kubrick did that because at that time, that's the only way.
Right.
And actually, the other day, I had a student who saw the postcard for Kubrick's Lolita on a bulletin board that I have, and he had seen Kubrick's, which is like, way to go.
Right.
And he'd seen the Jeremy Irons one.
Okay.
And he was commenting on how different they were.
Okay.
Because I think at the time that Kubrick made Lolita, the only way that you can make an American film out of that is to make it a comedy.
Right.
And that film's great. Speaking of Kubrick, yesterday I caught 20 minutes of 2001 on Turner Classic Movies, the scene where Dave is dismantling Hal's memory.
Mm-hmm.
My God, is that a great scene.
Okay, sir, your number four movie.
My number four movie is 12 Angry Men.
Yes. Which, as a first for this whole 100th episode favorite movie series, is the only movie on anyone's list that I had never seen. I had to borrow it from you and watch it.
Which I regard as a personal triumph. And the other day on the phone, you were a little mum, because I think you wanted to save it for the podcast.
Sure.
You said you liked it.
Yes.
But are you scratching your head at how much I like it?
Yes, a little bit. You've talked about the movie before.
Yes.
Once when you did the Sidney Lumet retrospective, and once when you talked about movies that we have to watch every time they're on. And that I totally get. Watching 12 Angry Men, I totally understand that, yes, this is an incredibly watchable movie that I could be easily drawn into if I'm flipping channels and I come past it like, oh, 12 Angry Men is on, and I watch 5 minutes, and then I got to watch the rest. That I get. But I am surprised that it's one of your five favorite movies of all time.
So now I'm on the hot seat. You can't see this, but Patrick has just turned on a very hot light above my head.
Which I had to bring specifically for this
and podcast. I have to account for myself. I think it's the most interesting mystery or policier ever written.
Okay.
I think the idea that we will not show the crime, we will not show the investigation, we will not show the court case, which of course is what every other film ever made does.
Right.
We're going to take you to this small room, and we're going to completely present the mystery through the jurors. I never duplicated.
No.
Maybe because people would scream, you're ripping off 12 Angry Men. I think the actors they chose are perfect.
Yeah.
As it turns out, this was done as a live television broadcast with Bob Cummings playing juror number 8. I can't quite picture that, although the TV version's on the Criterion disc. I just haven't watched it yet. Joseph Sweeney, who plays the elderly man, and George Voskovic, who plays the recent immigrant, which is a performance I love, are the only two holdouts from the TV drama.
Oh.
They recast every other part.
Okay.
And I read that later this year, Jack Klugman,
yes,
who is the only surviving member of the original movie cast, which is sad.
Yeah,
is going to be in a production of it, a live production of it, somewhere on the East Coast, where he will now play Juror 9, the elderly man.
Right.
So that would be interesting to see. I've served on some juries.
Mm-hmm.
I I find the film's depiction, considering how long ago the film was made, and maybe this is just specific to my jury case, which of course I'm not allowed to talk about, it's uncanny in the way it nails the fact that by nature of who our friends are, or where we work, or where we live, it is rare that a lot of us come in contact with people from every strata, from every point of view. And one of the few cases, and maybe this is why people hate jury duty so much secretly and try to get out of it, because it can't be that you love your job so much and you want to leave it, that I am now with people from every neighborhood in the city, every gender, every ethnicity, every religious belief, every political belief. And I think what happened in my jury room, though it was not a murder case, thank God, was very much like what transpires in the film, that you can't believe the beliefs that some people hold, given that all 12 of you have been witness to the same case.
Right.
I'll leave it at that. I think Henry Fonda character sort of embodies everything we want to be.
Right.
I think when you watch the film, you can't help but think, would I have the guts to say, can we just talk about this for an hour?
Yeah.
I think secretly we're all afraid that we might be Lee J. Cobb.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think as the film goes on, we realize we might be some of the jurors in between. And in a weird way, it's like a 12-sided Rorschach test, if that's a metaphor. What character in 12 right. Angry Men right. are you the most like? But I think I've seen it so many times that obviously the big moments, like when Henry Fonda whips out that switchblade and puts it down, and oh my God, it's such a great moment, that I find the moment I like the best is it starts to rain, and it's tremendously hot during the entire proceedings. Reginald Rose uses that to amp up the suspense. And it's tremendously hot. All the windows are open. In fact, halfway through the film, they realize how to get the fan to work, and it's a big thing. It starts to rain quite hard, and they have to run and close the windows. And Henry Fonda winds up next to Edward Binns, who's the jury foreman. And Binns looks out the window at the rain, and he's a high school coach. And he starts to tell this very sad story about something that happened. And it makes me realize that movies need more of that.
Right.
Because I think that happens in life. But it's not in the movie because it has nothing to do with the story. But it does.
Right.
That's our first glimpse, because Binns has really been trying to be, what's the word? Impartial.
Right.
That he has tremendous sympathy for the little kid who's on trial. And that's our inroad into that. So it's not like a wasted moment. I love, it's early in the morning. His son is now a famous environmentalist actor.
Ed Begley.
I love Ed Begley Sr.
Yeah.
as just the worst guy who ever lived. And, I think the one moment that my students might find rings false is, at the conclusion of the film, he's spouting horrible, hateful, racist diatribe to the extent that a film made at that time would allow him to vent.
Right.
And one by one, the men just get up and walk away from him.
Yeah.
And he's left alone. And it works as a visual metaphor, but somehow you think...
I won't say I had a problem with that scene, but it felt very stagey and...
And I'm trying to remember the character. The scene ends with one character saying, "Now sit down and don't open your mouth again."
Yeah, I don't remember who it was.
Because it's not Henry Fonda. In the Sidney Lumet In Memoriam that we did, I had half remembered something from Sidney Lumet's book, and anticipating this podcast, I looked it up. Remember, this is Sidney Lumet's first theatrical film.
Yeah.
He had done a lot of TV. This was his first theatrical film. What he did was he started with wide-angle lenses at eye height. He wanted the beginning of the film to approximate human vision. As the film goes along, he slowly lowers the camera and uses telephoto lenses to increase your sense of claustrophobia. Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those things. I read a little bit about the movie after watching it, and I've talked about this phenomenon before where you sort of watch a movie and you think, okay, that worked or it didn't work, and you're not necessarily aware of all the tricks that have been played on you. And then I read that and I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, I did. Now that I know that, there is a sense of that going on, and it's very impressive the way that he was able to sort of change the focus, that the whole movie takes place in this one room and is never boring and never, I don't think for the most part, feels stagey at all. You've talked a lot before about this feels like a play that someone filmed, and I don't think 12 Angry Men feels like that at all.
I think the one moment I just pointed out feels stagey.
When they get up and walk away.
Yeah. I agree with you in that I don't think anyone would watch the film and say it was really boring how they were all in that room.
Right, exactly. As somebody might, but that person shouldn't talk.
In fact, at one point they move things around and they recreate the old man's walk to the door.
Right.
And it's tremendously suspenseful.
I have to say, I love courtroom dramas and I love mysteries like this. There were so many things in this movie that I thought were so great. I loved all the performances. I loved Jack Warden. I actually thought Martin Balsam was so great in a role that didn't necessarily, up until he has that scene where he gets the speech.
Right, and I have to clarify, it's not Edward Binns. Edward Binns is the house painter who keeps sticking up for the old man.
Right.
It's Martin Balsam who has the monologue about the kid in the sports game.
And up until he gets that monologue, he's just sort of, okay, guys, we have to do this or this or this. And I just felt like he was so believable in that part as the guy who just was asked to be the one in charge and sort of has to play that role.
And at one point they get mad and he's like, listen, I don't have to do this. And everyone rushes, no, you're doing a terrific job, which you could anticipate happening.
Jack Warden is so great. So I loved all the actors.
Jack Warden is great as a boob.
Who wants to get out of there more than anything.
At one point he throws pieces of paper into the fan so that they bounce off and hit other jury members in the head. And what I think Sweeney says, that's an ignorant thing to do.
I was pulled out a little bit by the fact, and you're right, the way that they sort of reconstruct what happened, but when I stopped to think about it, I did have to ask myself, well, what did they talk about during the trial? Because these guys have now done all of the police work and all of the legal work in just this jury room. So what has everybody else been doing?
Rose does deal with that.
Yeah.
Because at various points in the film, when Henry Fonda keeps making points, the men who are against him say, why didn't they bring that up in the courtroom?
Right.
And they say, it was a court-appointed lawyer. You can't get famous with this case. He didn't look like he wanted to take the case.
Well, and what I liked was that Henry Fonda kept bringing up the point of, isn't it possible? He's not necessarily saying this is what happened, but it's just we have to open our minds to the possibility that, you know, we didn't.
And at one point, Voskovic even says, maybe you don't understand the concept of a reasonable doubt.
Right.
At which point the other guy gets really angry because don't you go schooling me.
The other moment that I won't say rang false for me, the guy standing up turning their backs, that was one. And honestly, Lee J. Cobb's final meltdown and transition into changing his mind, I don't see how he arrives at the other place.
Given how clever the rest of the film is about revealing some things, that seems really 50s, actor's studio.
Right.
Oh, it was his problem with his own son.
Right.
It seems curious.
And kind of rushed, just like, well, we got to get this 12th guy on board, so let's wrap it up. But yeah, a really, really, really good movie. What is next for you, sir?
So now we're on 3.
Yeah, we are.
And the other night I was thinking, well, shouldn't the entire list have been horror films? But I don't want to present myself as a not well-rounded person, because I am well-rounded.
So number 3 is Night of the Lepus?
No, although I showed this to Patrick before we started. Night of the Lepus, which I talked about as being one of the worst horror films ever made, is now available courtesy of Warner's Manufacture on Demand. You can get yourself a copy of Night of the Lepus.
When you ordered it, did you get an email back saying, are you sure? Because we'll make it. We just want to make sure.
We want your money.
How many eyes does horror have?
The cover of the DVD has this sort of sketchy oil painting that doesn't show the monster but shows a bunch of eyes. I think it works. Patrick doesn't. But then you turn over the DVD case and there's a picture that looks like it belongs on Facebook that someone took of their pet bunny. And this is truth in advertising because you can't send this back.
Right.
We showed you the monster.
Right. Your hair will stand on end, H-A-R-E, it says.
Does it really?
Yeah, on the back, right above the picture of the bunny. Your hair will stand
on it. I didn't read that. From the ridiculous to the sublime, my third movie is The Bride of Frankenstein.
Yes.
Which I've spoken about at some length. Years and years and years ago, F This Movie fan Miguel and I traveled to the West Coast to attend a horror movie convention. And it turned out to be this big thing that people still talk about for a number of reasons. I've told the Michael Jackson story. That's where the Michael Jackson story transpired. And they took a poll of all the writers and directors and actors who were attending this function. And at the dinner on the last night, they announced that, in their opinion, the opinion of the assembled multitude, Bride of Frankenstein was the single greatest horror film ever made. I love Bride of Frankenstein so much that it's hard to talk about it. And I think I've mentioned in the past that all of these Universal films take place in Monster Town, in Monsterland, this sort of nameless European village where all of these things transpire, and you could easily imagine all of the films taking place at the same time, sort of like a theme park attraction that's run amok. James Whale did not want to make Bride of Frankenstein. He felt he had wrung the idea dry by making Frankenstein. He kept putting it off. Universal kept allowing him to make other films, including The Invisible Man, but he finally tackled the Frankenstein sequel, and he didn't think he could top it, so he decided to make it a hoot. Let's send this up.
Right.
But I think it still works as a horror film. It also still works as a parody of a horror film.
Right.
There's so many strange little things going on in this film that it's hard to list them all. I wish I could live in Monster Town. I wish I could be in black and white. I wish I could date the Bride of Frankenstein. She's alive for such a short time. It's just a shame. I recently read that her hiss at the end, which is my favorite moment, she was imitating the swans in Regent's Park. I guess Whale filmed that so many times from so many different angles that she lost her voice because she had a sort of hiss all afternoon long. Every performance is great. It's a shame that Universal and Whale sort of cut it up, because in its original form, it made a lot more sense. There was supposed to be a character played by Dwight Frye who was killing people for their money and blaming the murders on the monster. That doesn't come across at all in the film. Whale, I think, cut that stuff out because the Breen office thought the film was too violent, and he thought those were the murders he could lose.
Right.
But unfortunately, in the film, the way we have it now, we assume the monster has committed all those murders.
Right.
So, ironically, if they had left it the old way, the monster would have been more sympathetic. You stay, we belong dead, is one of the greatest lines, and that was a last-minute... That was a last-minute idea, because at the last minute, you know, last-minute-wise, they decided to let the
not the minutes before that.
No, the very last minute. It was a last-minute-y type of thing that was last-minute-like in its execution. That they decided to allow Dr. Frankenstein and his wife to escape, which seems odd, because earlier the monster hates Dr. Frankenstein.
Right, right.
But actually Universal wanted that because they wanted to continue to make sequels. Little did they know that, tragically, Colin Clive, who plays Dr. Frankenstein, was an alcoholic of epic proportions, and very sadly, he would be dead by the time they got around to making Son of Frankenstein. It's a film that I love so much, it's hard to talk about.
Yeah, right. And there are definitely those movies. And that's part of why we kind of did this series, was because I don't think we could ever do a whole... I mean, we could definitely do a whole show on Bride of Frankenstein, but it turns into the Chris Farley Show. I think if you're only going to pick one horror movie, as obviously you have to on your list to sort of represent all other horror movies, I think Bride of Frankenstein is the one to go with. Because I do think it's probably the best horror movie ever made. And I talked about this a little bit with Mike, and I didn't know some of the things that you're talking about with Bride of Frankenstein, but we talked a little bit about how sometimes these great movies happen sort of by accident. And I don't necessarily think Bride of Frankenstein happened by accident, but think about all the things that make it great that almost didn't happen, including James Whale not making the movie.
Universal originally wanted Claude Rains to play Dr. Pretorius because he had been such a big success in Invisible Man. This would be a very different film if Claude Rains played Dr. Pretorius.
He's the best thing about the movie. I don't know. He's my favorite thing about that movie.
Have a cigar. It's my only weakness.
The Bride of Frankenstein.
And I could just see James Whale saying, cut, Ernest. If you could chew the scenery a little bit more. You had your teeth in it, but can you... I've seen you chew the scenery. The Bride of Frankenstein. annoying autobiographical note. I love the film so much. I was in charge of the talents show at my high school for many, many years. And one year, Doug, of F This Movie Watching Trailers with Doug fame, appeared in a sketch where we took the final scene of Bride of Frankenstein and staged it as if it were a musical to Elvis Costello songs. What were we thinking? Doug played Pretorius.
Yes, he did. He does an excellent Pretorius.
Yeah, he caught that sort of over-effusive thing.
All right, so let's move on to your number two. Everybody needs to see Bride of Frankenstein. If you want to hear us talk a little bit more about it, go back to our best
horror movies podcast
from 2010, I think.
My number two film for decades was my number one film because if you teach film study in a public high school, you will be asked what your favorite movie of all time is on a daily basis. Right. And of course, that question's impossible to answer. And so I chose Singing in the Rain because it was a convenient answer that most people would agree with because many people who have never seen older films have seen Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
I would argue Singing in the Rain is an older film for people who don't like older films. I've long said it's a musical for people who don't like musicals. And Singing in the Rain is, I think, the greatest musical of all time, certainly the best MGM musical of that time, of that epoch. And it's interesting that Singing in the Rain never got the awards and the recognition it deserved when it was first released because An American in Paris had been released the year before and won all the awards.
Right.
So you're done. You won. Don't make your best film after your third best film.
Right.
Frank Capra once said this when talking about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which he regarded as his best film. I think it's his best film. Mm-hmm. At this point, Doug raises a serious objection. In his autobiography, he said, the lesson I learned was, don't make your greatest film the year someone else makes Gone with the Wind. Because that was 1939.
Yeah.
It's a great comedy that holds up. The nature of the musical numbers don't pull you out of the film so that you get that phenomenon where people think the plot has stopped just for the sake of a musical number. It's what they call an integrated musical, which started with Oklahoma, where it's not that the Marx Brothers plot stops dead so the romantic leads can sing about drinking tea with each other. The musical numbers reveal character or advance the plot or are a recreation of something. Great script by Betty Comden and Adolph Green. In real life, they were married. The producer, Arthur Freed, handed them a whole bunch of songs that he had written and said, let's make a movie out of this. Maybe it'll get my songs, you know, popular again. All the songs were written in the late 20s, early 30s for some of the first musicals ever made. And they said, these don't sound like contemporary songs from the 50s. That was part of their decision to set the film in the past. We have a film in the 50s that actually takes place in the 20s. And it's very satiric. Supposedly, they went around the MGM lot and asked old-timers for stories about things that happened when sound first came in. There's a sequence where they're recording the first sound, a Donald Lockwood movie, the Gene Kelly character, and all these things happen with the mic, and it's very funny. But I think the reason I chose it, beyond the fact that when Gene Kelly and or Donald O'Connor dance, it's this amazing thing that you watch, and the cliche is they make it look easy.
Right.
But at one point, O'Connor is so full of energy and love that he runs up the wall and does a backflip. That's really hard.
Yeah.
And in fact, when they did it, they had to angle the wall a little bit because he wasn't in his 20s anymore. And he said he felt embarrassed. But I'm like, you know, you have nothing to feel embarrassed about. It's the make 'em laugh sequence. Is one of the gems. Every year I go to Ebertfest. And at one very early Ebertfest, he saved Singing in the Rain for Sunday, and the guest was Donald O'Connor.
Wow.
And I debated, because you've been there for several days. Do you want to stay for the last film, or do you want to go home early? You want to get an early ride home because you got to go to work the next day. And I debated, and I debated, and I wound up staying. And I was so glad that I did, because after the film, he told amazing stories about the making of the film. He debunked some rumors. Some famous stories about the film are not true. And 6 months later, really? He passed away. Wow. So I'm so glad I stayed. The story that I actually used to tell, because in the words of John Ford in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when fact meets legend, print the legend. That some of these stories are so irresistible, they get passed around and around and around. That Donald O'Connor filmed the Make 'Em Laugh number in one day, filming over and over and over, and he's got knee pads under his pants, and he's doing all these flips and twists, and he's exhausted. And he goes home, he gets in a bathtub, his wife gives him a martini, and there's a phone call from the studio. It's Kelly. The lens was fogged. He has to do it again. That never happened.
Wow.
Someone asked him.
Right.
At the Virginia. He said no. He thinks a publicist made that up because it makes good copy or something. That the rumor was Debbie Reynolds practiced her dancing until her feet bled and her shoes were full of blood. Which sounds like it's from a horror film.
Yeah, right.
According to Donald O'Connor, that never happened. And I was so glad that I got to hear him speak. Bottom line, though, and I've said this ad nauseum, Singing in the Rain is a film that suggests that life can be an adventure and romantic love is possible. Mm-hmm. And we live in a very cynical age. Oh, am I? I'm starting.
Jerry Maguire. Your boy TC.
And at this point, Patton Oswalt's brother speaks up. It makes me sad. It honestly makes me sad that some of my students are so cynical and so jaded by 17 that they reject the film.
Really?
Because it presents a view of life that they find as unrealistic as a cartoon, as unrealistic as a Pollyanna or some sort of fairy tale. And, you know, I've been lucky. I have a very good life, and I love my wife, and so I certainly agree with the film. I think you would, too.
Yes.
And he's more cynical than me, folks.
Well, that's the thing. I do consider myself to be a pretty cynical person, but yeah, I could not resist Singing in the Rain. I saw it for the first time as a teenager. I don't like musicals for the most part. And yet, oddly enough, I love when there's musical numbers in things that aren't musicals.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of 500 Days of Summer, when it suddenly becomes...
Anytime a movie breaks into song but isn't a musical, I love it. But for the most part, I don't love musicals, but I love Singing in the Rain.
2 weeks ago, when I did the Better Yet lists, the musical one was really hard.
Yeah.
Because looking at lists of every musical ever made, I really don't like musicals either.
That category and I think Westerns were the two where I was not as strong as in the other. The other ones I'd seen most of that you had named, but musicals and Westerns I fell short.
My son, last week in class, saw All That Jazz for the first time.
Okay, the Roy Scheider version.
Yeah, knocked him out. He loved it. And I think All That Jazz might be a musical for people who are really cynical.
Because
that film supports all of your negative notions. I cut you off. Continue talking about Singing in the Rain.
No, I just love it. I think it absolutely holds up as a comedy. I think it's so funny. I think it has such great characters and performances. I think Gene Hagen is so great. I think Donald O'Connor is so great. And honestly, that was the first movie I'd ever seen with Gene Kelly. And it was this revelation. Not only watching him sing and dance, which he does incredibly well, but his comic timing, his charisma, I was just like, they don't make movie stars like this anymore.
At the beginning of the film, we're at a big 1920s movie premiere, and he's playing the insufferable, arrogant star.
Right.
And all the press is around he and his co-star, And every time they flash a picture, he leans forward and makes this face. And it's this funny, fake movie style. Yeah. You know exactly what that picture in the magazine.
Right.
You mentioned Gene Hagen. And I don't think they ever ported this commentary over, which is a shame. The first Laserdisc I ever bought was the Criterion Collection, Singing in the Rain, which had a commentary track by Ronald Haver, who had done some serious research okay. into that film. Stories I tell my kids are still stuff I learned from Haver. When they decide to make this film that's failing a musical, they have Debbie Reynolds record the songs, and they have Lena Lamont, who doesn't have a very good speaking voice or singing voice, just mime them. So there's a sequence where we see Debbie Reynolds recording the song, them playing it on a record for Lena, Lena learning it, Lena lip-syncing it, and then we see what it looks like in the finished film. It's a wonderful montage. Apparently, Debbie Reynolds' voice didn't fit that song.
She sang and sang. She practiced singing until her throat had filled with blood.
And so Gene Hagen, who's doing a character voice in the film, it's a comedy, weird, mishmash, high-pitched nonsense, she actually had a beautiful singing voice and recorded the song. So in a sequence that's designed to make you think one thing, it's Debbie Reynolds who's actually lip-syncing to that.
And Gene Hagen lip-syncing to herself,
right. Which is why at the very end, when it's married together,
yeah.
it looks right. really good. right. It's like, that seems to go together well. And finally, a Twilight Zone moment, because I bounce this off of my students every year. We're watching a film where a famous movie actor is famous for silent films. Oh, kind of like...
Well, I was going to get to this, but go ahead.
And when talkies come, it looks like his career is ruined, but they decide to make a musical, and he becomes a great success. In the middle of this, he falls in love with this girl, and his leading lady does not want him to fall in love with this girl, but love triumphs, and at the end, they're together, and they kiss. And the camera pulls back, and we see that the two of them, their movie characters, it is assumed, then made a film called Singing in the Rain. The camera pulls back. We see a billboard for Singing in the Rain starring Don Lockwood and Kathy Seldon. Now, we're watching a movie called Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds. At the end of Singing in the Rain, when the camera pulls back and we see that billboard, is the next movie they made the movie we just saw? Every year that freaks out my students.
I just think if you're a person who has not seen a lot of classic movies because you feel like you can't relate to them or something, that they don't have the contemporary sensibilities, I think you should see Singing in the Rain because, again, for me it was sort of this revelation that I felt cheated that I had missed out on so many old movies that they could be still so funny and energetic and feel so contemporary and that they didn't make movie stars like Gene Kelly. We've taken a little bit of criticism for our comments regarding The Artist, that we've been maybe perhaps a little bit too hard on The Artist. The Artist is fine, but it's amazing to me that it seems poised right now to win Best Picture, because all I could think about when I saw the movie was that everything that I like about it was done 60 years ago and better
yeah.
by Singing in the Rain. And again, it's a movie, I won't say it's a love letter to cinema because no one should say those words. But like, if you're somebody who loves movies, it's also, you kind of learn something about the transition from silent film to sound film in a very, very entertaining way.
I think you learn more about the transition from silent to sound than you do in The Artist.
Absolutely.
And I've said this before, and I'm glad that The Artist was made, and I'm glad that people enjoy
yeah.
it. My quibble... was, like Hugo, this film seems designed to really appeal to me.
Right.
And it left me cold.
Yeah.
And I think Patrick and I had the same reaction. I don't think this is a spoiler. The Artist ends with an amazing musical number.
Do more of that.
And both of us had the same right. reaction. More of that.
Good job saving the very entertaining thing for the very end. Yes, so perhaps if you were right now going to do a very brief shitting on the classics, you could say, The Artist, better yet, see Singing in the Rain.
So now I can just write that for next Tuesday?
Done. It's done. Your number one film of all time.
And this is very recent, because again, for decades, it was the convenient answer. Singing in the Rain, and people would go, aha, okay, and I would be done. But in the last 10 years, I realized there's a film that I like more, and I have a feeling you've heard of it. It's called Casablanca.
And fill me in.
Seriously?
No.
No, you too. They still show it every Valentine's Day.
Yes, they
at
do.
The Music Box, which, if you think about it, is a twisted and demented choice.
Kind of, yeah. You know what they should show? That movie Valentine's Day.
That sells itself.
Yeah.
That markets itself.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I like about Casablanca is that it is a romantic drama that doesn't end quite like many romantic dramas, because I think the film has something else on its mind. To give credit where credit is due, yesterday afternoon I was discussing the film with my wife, who is far more intelligent than I am. So some of these ideas I'm just parroting like a parrot, like the bird. She said
right.
them, I'm repeating them.
Right.
I'm not parroting them.
No.
That would be me.
Like Mel Brooks.
So we have a romantic drama where a woman has to choose between two men, and that's a cliche. That's the stuff of many romantic dramas. But you also have a film that's talking about something else, and I think ultimately this is one of the reasons why it's my favorite film of all time. And I think ultimately it's the reason why it wins Best Picture that year. That accidentally or not, they made a film where the main character is a symbol for America in the years leading up to World War II. That the film explicitly presents a critique of isolationism.
Mm-hmm.
That at the beginning, Rick Blaine, the coolest man who ever lived, is in French Morocco, and he owns this bar. And he has a motto, I stick my neck out for nobody. And it's interesting that such an isolated island of a man would be in the business of running this bar and casino and restaurant where obviously people come to be together, to congregate. And as the film goes along, we learn how he became that way. But by and large, the film is about his decision to not be that way anymore, to take a stand, to become involved, even to his own detriment. And I think, I don't know if the filmmakers were thinking of this at the time, but in the months running up to Pearl Harbor, Rick becomes a very convenient stand-in for America and its isolationist views. It's very romantic. Every performance is perfect.
Yeah.
Every role is cast impeccably. I keep going back to the Sydney Greenstreet character because I love Sydney Greenstreet so much. And Peter Lorre, who's actually not in the film very long, I think Claude Rains steals the picture. He has some of the best lines. Cesare in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari shows up. Oh, again, a moment where I go up for a name and I lost it. You see, children, this is why my favorite films are in black and white, because I'm 88. It'll come to me. He plays Major Strasser.
Okay.
Nice little role. Great music, because you have Dooley Wilson singing all those songs. I think it's the perfect film. And like Bride of Frankenstein, it's a place I wish I could visit.
Right.
And I almost did. When I was in my teens,
I found a time machine.
But that's a story for another day. When I was in my teens, a very large hotel downtown completely redid their lobby bar to be an exact recreation of Rick's Cafe American. And I read about it in the newspaper, and I dreamed about it, and by the time I was old enough to go, it had closed.
Mm. It would have been in color.
It's like, well, I don't know. with the lighting, with the right lighting at night and the walls painted the way they were, I so wish I could have seen that, as if only to see their recreation. I've read that Hugh Hefner's inspiration for starting the Playboy Clubs was Rick's Cafe American.
Interesting.
Everybody comes to Rick's. You and Mike had talked about this. Some of the other F This Movie guys had talked about this. There are many of them, but it's a perfect film.
Yeah. And that's what that's really my only contribution, is that it is an example of just every single element working in a movie.
And
great script, great performances, great direction, great every single thing about it works. And I almost think it's like the model, I think, for here's when you do everything right.
The gentleman who runs the classes on how to write a script, he's famous.
Robert McKee?
I believe that's him. Okay. Has called it the most perfect American movie script ever written. It's Bogart's first time playing a romantic lead, yeah, and that obviously leads to the second part of his career.
Right.
I discovered there are some misconceptions, like these legends that are passed along. For the longest time, people said that they kept rewriting the script. So one of the reasons why Ingrid Bergman's performance worked is that she didn't know who she was going to end up with. Apparently, that's a myth.
Okay.
She knew.
Right.
Later, she gave an interview where she said emotionally, when she was making the film, she didn't know which one to favor.
Oh, okay.
And people misinterpreted that to mean, well, she shows ambivalence so well because she... No, she knew.
Right.
There's proof
right.
that she knew. Al Jean Harmetz wrote a making-of book
okay.
for Casablanca. I believe it's called Round Up the Usual Suspects. It's amazing. The only thing that keeps it from being more amazing is that she wrote the single greatest making-of book ever.
Which is?
The Making of the Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
Oh, my God, you should read that. The research she did, and she did it at a time where she could still get access to some of the original people. That's the most amazing making-of book I've ever read. So Ingrid Bergman knew that she was going to end up with Paul Henreid. The other thing, and this is something that I propagated for years. In the Great Movie Ride at Disney MGM Studios mm-hmm. in Florida,
mm-hmm.
this little tram takes you past all these movie scenes that are recreated with robots. And we see Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain, and we see Wizard of Oz. And at one point, we drive past Bogart saying goodbye to Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca. And in the background, there's a plane, because they're right. at the airport. For the longest time, I guess Disney even tried to float this dubious proposition, and I believed it, that the plane in the Great Movie Ride was the actual plane they used in the film.
Okay.
And if that was the case, they should have had the tram operator tell you that.
Yeah, right.
That,
right.
Man,
right.
that's right. something from the original film.
Right.
Because when they filmed that scene in Casablanca, they used forced perspective, a tiny little plane, and midgets... I'm sorry, little people, as the ground crew to create the illusion that it was a full-size plane that was way in the background. That's another reason why they made it foggy, to hide the illusion.
Wow.
But I have it on very good authority that is not true.
Okay.
The plane in the Great Movie Ride is not the plane from the movie. I spread that for 10 years. I stand corrected. I'm sorry. But you look at that last scene, and certainly the first time I saw this movie, I wasn't used to that in movies. And I certainly wasn't used to that.
Sort of the non-happy ending, you mean?
That Bogart makes a tremendous sacrifice at right. the end.
Which, again, is the only way the movie works.
Yeah.
Especially if you're reading it, like you said, as sort of a metaphor for entering into the war, that it requires sacrifice.
Exactly. And if it ends the other way, he's really awful.
Right.
I mean, if it right. goes the right. way that he's right. pretending it's going to go.
Right.
But just something so noble about the sacrifice, and that makes him cool again. And yet, you suspect he's not going to go back to the island. And the very famous last shot,
right.
I actually read the last line was an afterthought, that they had to call Humphrey Bogart back months later to wow. dub it, because Howard Koch, the producer, came up with Louis,
again, one of the,
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
One of, if not the most famous lines in movie history.
And clearly, he had a real handle on what the film was about. Because again, if Rick is an island at the beginning of the film, we want something at the end to indicate he is not going to go back to the way he was.
Right.
And that he's going to strike up this friendship with Claude Rains.
All right, awesome. Thank you very much, JB. Everybody get excited about the F This Movie Fest on February 4th. Sign up for Twitter, twitter.com/FThisMovie. Make sure you follow us. Starting at noon instead of noon. The next episode you hear will be our 100th episode.
Honk, honk.
Ding, ding. Bye, everybody.